This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We advertised the Shir this week starts a series which will be based not on the Parsha of the week as we have done for the past many years, but working through some of the ideas of the opening of the Torah of Bereshis consecutively. And we'll see how it goes between now and the end of the year, and then we'll decide whether to continue doing that through next year or whether to go back to the old format. Just as an aside, one of the very beautiful, one of the astonishingly amazing pieces of Chazal is the opening Rashi on the Torah, and one has to appreciate the degree of beauty in it. One has to understand, one has to prepare oneself. We tend to take the Torah for granted. It's like they tell the story. A chassid tells the story. That's why I feel free to be able to repeat it. That he's sitting in a base of medrash, and somebody was learning from a sefer Tanya, and when he'd finished the Tanya, he sort of threw the sefer. He was a bit rough with the sefer. The one chassid got very angry with him. He said, "What do you think that is? That's a Tanya. What do you think? It's a chumashul." And that's how we tend to be a chumashul. The Torah is a chumash. We're so accustomed to it. We're raised on it from childhood. We use it every Shabbos. We're so comfortable and at home with it. But at the end of the day, this is the Torah. And Bereshis Boro Elohim, this is the opening phrase of the most important statement that was ever made. This is the most important piece of literature. It's the most important piece of philosophy. It's the most important piece of theology. It's the most important legislation. It's the most important piece of politics. It's plain and simply the most important piece of writing that has ever existed and will ever exist in mankind. So although you've got a little 5-year-old cheder kid starts reading Bereshis Boro Elohim, that doesn't in any way detract from the gravity of what it means. And here we've got this, the most authoritative of all texts. There is no text more authoritative than the Torah. One can ask questions on it, and there are things we don't understand about it, and things we've got to query, which we'll do in this Shir and Yitz Hashem. But however you want to take it, it's accepted worldwide by more people than any other text, with more authority than any other text. Even the Americans probably treat the Torah with at least as much respect as the American Constitution. It's extremely authoritative. And imagine an authoritative, take the American Constitution, imagine reading one of the most authoritative comments on the American Constitution. And imagine opening it on the first page of the Constitution and the first page of the comment. Here we've got Lahavdil, the Torah itself, first page, first sentence. What is Rashi's opening concept, opening comment? Torah starting at the wrong place. This isn't the place to start. And that sets the tone of our relationship with Torah. We're not fazed by its gravity. We're not fazed by its authority. We're willing to challenge from the very beginning. And that's how Rashi opens up. He doesn't open up modestly with "this is the great Torah and let's understand what it means." He opens up with this exclamation in the name of Rabbi Yitzchok. Is this the place to start a book of law? Do we have to have chapters and chapters and chapters of stories about the creation and Adam and Chava and the snake and Noach and Avram and Yitzchok and Yaakov before we start getting to the real stuff? The real stuff is the halachas. The real stuff are the laws. What are we supposed to keep? What is all this for? Why are we given all this? Is it that we need to know that God made the world? We're told that in the Ten Commandments. When the laws of Shabbos are given, we're told, "Kishesh yisyomim mosa Hashem es ha-shamayim v'horetz." In 6 days Hashem created the world, and on the seventh day He rested. So what more do you have to know than that? If we want to know history, we'll consult the history books. If we want to know about sociology, we'll consult the sociologists. We don't use this as our text for history in any case. We don't use this as our text for science. We don't use this as our text for sociology. We use this as our text for morality, for halacha, to know what to do and what not to do. So why start here? So Rashi answers in what appears to be a simplistic answer, but we need to understand the deeper meaning. And he says, "Shim yomru umos ha'olam liYisrael listim atem," because if one day it should happen that there will be an Arafat who will gather the sympathies of the world and will say, "You are robbers, you have no right to be in Israel." And if one listens carefully to what they're saying, they are not saying you have no right to be in Gaza. They are not saying you have no right to be on the West Bank. They're just phrasing it quite intelligently. What they're saying is you have no right to be in Jerusalem. You have no right to be in Israel. Exactly what this Rashi says will happen, that's what's happening today. The Goyim will get together and this movement will gain more and more momentum. Let's not think that it's going to subside. It's going to gather more and more momentum. And the more we give away to them, the more momentum it gathers. And they're going to say, listen, the fact that you're giving it back to us means you yourselves are acknowledging. So you're giving back what you took in the Six-Day War. So why are you giving back what you took in the Six-Day War and not in the War of Independence? What's the difference? The one was a little bit longer ago. The fact is you're accepting that it was taken by war. It was taken by robbery. And if you've accepted that for the Six-Day Wars, how are they going to justify that they've given back the territory that they took in the Six-Day War and they're not going to give back the territory that they took in the War of Independence? There's no logical justification. So they're actually forcing themselves politically. Who knows what plans God has got? We don't know. But the political cause and effect, if God's removed from the picture, then I could guarantee you that within a number of years, I don't know how much, they will have to give the whole of Israel back. There's no way they'll be able to keep it. They won't be able to keep it militarily. They won't be able to keep it politically. And they certainly won't be able to keep it logically with any kind of rational argument. They will have to give it back. There's just no question. So it's going to need some kind of major miracle to be able to keep on to be able to hold it. So when such a time comes that they say, Listimatem, what should our answer have been? Here we've got it. We should have said, we could have answered, Kol Horet Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The whole world belongs to Hashem. Hu Bara'o, He created it. Unesono Lashe Yoshov Be'enov, and He gave it to whoever it was correct in His eyes to give it to. Biritzoino Unesono Lohem, Uviritzoino Nentono Mehem Unesono Lohem. He decided to give the land of Canaan to the seven nations of Canaan up till a certain point, and He then decided to remove it from them and to give it to us. That's His decision. And so we have a historic claim to it based on the Torah. At some point in history, God decided to shift the ownership of Eretz Yisrael from the seven nations to ourselves, and we're claiming what God gave us. So the Torah would then be the source. And had we fought it theologically, we would have had a far better ground to stand on, because the Christian world would have had to accept it. We decided to fight it politically. And politically, the Christian world is free to side with whichever side they want. And if it suits them to side with the Arabs, they'll side with the Arabs. If it suits them to side with the Muslims, they'll side with the Muslims. But if we'd used the Torah as our basis, the Old Testament is accepted by the Goyim as well. And they wouldn't have had an argument. We would have had a moral argument at least, which would have gathered the religious Western world on our side rather than on the Arab side. So you might ask, why did the Israeli government not use the Torah? Because there's a price to pay. The obvious answer then of the Christian world would have been, that's very fine, you want to use the Torah, but then why don't you have a religious state? Why does the Prime Minister come to a banquet in Washington and eat tref? That's a little bit of an embarrassing question. So if you want to keep the Torah as your origin, you would have to have a religious government. You would have to have a government of people who are observing the Torah, who value the Torah. And that they weren't prepared to do. So they rather used a sick argument, which they're losing, so as not to have to use the Torah, which would create a personal obligation upon them to adhere to the Torah, which they weren't prepared to accept. Anyway, that's an aside. That's what Rashi says. But what does it mean, really? Is that really why the Torah started? Is the whole first section of the Torah, right until the parsha in Shemos, is all of that only to give us an answer to the Arab world today, which in any case we haven't bothered to use? Is that the whole thing? It goes further than that. It goes deeper than that. What Rashi is telling us is that the Torah deals with the relationship between man and his environment in a unique way. There are many studies that deal with the relationship between man and his environment. Almost every study does. The arts do. The sciences do. The social sciences do. They all deal with the relationship between man and his environment. What's unique about the Torah is it deals with the relationship between man and his environment with the religious dimension thrown in. So it adds an additional dimension to the analysis between man and, of the relationship between man and his environment. If you took the religious dimension out, then the dispute about Eretz Israel, for example, would be a political dispute. That's all. It would be a political and a military dispute. With the divine dimension in, then the relationship to Eretz Israel revolves around man's moral relationship with his land, with the world, with his country, with nationalism. And then we've got to look at the history of it a little bit. And if you read through the Torah, let's say, for example, if we didn't have the divine dimension, let's say our knowledge of events was only secular history. We had no knowledge of the divine dimension. And we knew that a man, Adam, came along. We didn't know exactly how he was born or created, which isn't such a big problem. They don't know how the whole world was created, so that doesn't seem to bother them. So a man came along, and they don't know where he came from, but there he was. And he and Chava lived in the Garden of Eden, and they left it. All of a sudden, they walked out and never came back. Now, the theories would start. It was very hot and they couldn't find water, so they went to look for water. Chava was running off with an ape and Adam went running after her. The sociologists would have found their reasons. The physicists would have found their reasons. Each science would have found its angle to explain why Adam and Chava picked out. Add the divine dimension, Adam and Chava misbehaved themselves and they were thrown out. The area no longer tolerated them. Hashem wasn't willing to continue embracing them in Gan Eden after the event of eating from the tree. If we look at the period of Noach, all of a sudden there's a flood. If that's all we knew about it, we had secular knowledge of there having been a flood at a particular time, and there was a man, Noach, who built an ark, what would they have said? So there was a flood, so the physicists would have explained how the rain came and why there was a flood at that particular time, and the earth tilted and seasons changed and all sorts of things happened. And there was a man called Noach who was a bit crazy, and he was a boat builder. Who knows what they would have said and how they would have explained it. They would have found sociological, psychological and physical explanations for everything that happened. They wouldn't deal with one issue, and that is, why did it all happen? That wouldn't be an issue. If you take the divine element out, you can't ask why. If there's no divine element, the answer to why is, why not? Coincidence. The moment there's the why question is only a valid question if the divine dimension exists in one's interpretation of events. If the divine dimension does not exist in the interpretation of events, you can ask how things happened, but you can't ask why things happened. And then we would go on with the story of the Tower of Babel, with Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov. We could go through the whole of the history of mankind up until the time of the giving of the Torah or thereafter, and we would be able to explain cause and effect without the divine dimension. But we wouldn't have realized that man's loss of his environment was a function of his moral relationship with that environment. That would not have been an admissible way of understanding it. That's not a scientific way of understanding it. The idea of chet, the idea of doing wrong, the idea of transgressing spiritual principles, the idea of transgressing moral principles, and those moral principles or the transgression of those moral principles impacting on the relationship between man and his physical environment, that we wouldn't have had. And that's what's unique about the Torah. And very few religions adopt that approach. That there's a morality everybody accepts. Even people who have no religion, even atheists, accept that there's a morality. That there's an ethic everybody accepts. The chiddush of the Torah is that morality and ethic affects the physical relationship between man and his environment. It affects health, it affects wealth, it affects rainfall, it affects all sorts of things. It affects politics. That there is a relationship, there is a dynamic. It's not an add-on. Morality is not an add-on to life. That life is really about normal cause and effect, and about economics and commerce and science, physics, chemistry, botany, zoology, and there's morality there as well. It's the way people behave to each other. It's not that at all. The chiddush of the Torah is that morality is at the very center of all these other disciplines, and that the infringement or the transgression of moral principles impacts on every other discipline. It's like a ripple in a pond. It moves outwards and there's nothing that isn't touched by the ripple. It's not like something that's on the edge of the pond. All the disciplines are around the edge of the pond. But a moral transgression, or on the other hand, a moral achievement, is like a ripple right at the center of the pond, and it moves out and everything is touched by it, everything is affected by it. That's what the first part of the Torah comes to teach us. that when it comes to the laws section later on, that we should know the meaning of those laws. Those aren't just laws that get added on and tagged on. Those aren't just sociological norms. Those aren't just customs that some ancient people adopted for themselves. That all of those have their roots in something so fundamental that it has the capacity to radically alter man's relationship with the world around him. That's what needs to exist there. And that's our answer to the nations of the world when they come and say, and why have you taken Eretz Yisrael? They say, look, let's start at the beginning. Let's figure out what is the relationship between man and lands. People have moved from lands. What determines whether they're in a land or not? What determines is God's will as reached through the moral actions of those individuals. We've lost Eretz Yisrael too on several occasions. And God forbid we could lose it again. That's been the history of mankind, that when we're not up to it, we lose. There's no guarantee. Guarantee, after Mashiach comes, we'll finally have the guarantee because there will be a permanence to our moral standards, some degree of permanence. But until then, there are ups and there are downs, and we do things that are right and we do things that are wrong, and sometimes as a nation we do things that are so bad that the nation, that the land is no longer ours. Hashem kicks us out, He's kicked us out, He's kicked other people out. Right now, we're there. That's the nature of that relationship. And that really has to be our understanding. As we go through these shiurim, that's how we're going to be looking at the Torah, to try and understand what is the Torah teaching us about that amazing, mysterious link. When I say mysterious, not because it's difficult to understand, but because it's difficult to see. That mysterious link between man's actions, man's moral actions, and his relationship with the physical universe in which he lives. That's what the Torah is all about. That's what every sentence of the Torah is all about. And that's how we're going to analyze them. Now, I mentioned last night that the first part of the Torah is divided into two sections. The one section is pre-Shabbos and the one is after Shabbos, or if you want to refer to it as the 6 days of creation and the rest of the Torah. And they're very different sections, and their meaning is different, and our method of understanding them and interpreting them is different. The Medrash says, On the pasuk in Mishle, Kavod Elokim Hester Dover Uchvod Malachim Chakir Dover, it is the honor of the divine honor entails mystery, and royal honor entails discovery. And I spoke last night, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail this evening, about the polarity between mystery and discovery. That discovery depends on mystery, and mystery depends on discovery. There is no mystery if you don't have a curious person trying to discover it. There's nothing mysterious about it. It only becomes mysterious when you've got somebody trying to uncover it. And there's no way of discovery if there's no mystery. Man is motivated in his movements through life, in nearly everything he does, by that very strange dynamic of the polarity between mystery and discovery. And we talked about it last night in a variety of areas, including in the interpersonal relationships, and in the inner personal relationships, one's relationship to oneself, as well as one's relationship to one another. There can be no discovery if there is no mystery. There can be no mystery if there is no process of discovery. And on that pasuk, the Medrash says, "Mitchilas ha-sefer v'ad kan," from the beginning of the book, which is where we're starting right now, until that point, the end of the sixth day, "Kved Elokim hu esther dover," that's dealing with the honor of God in mystery, in creating mystery. From there onwards starts the process of discovery. So up until the end of the sixth day, God creates the mystery. And obviously He carries on feeding the mystery. It's not as if the creation stops then. We're saying, every day God is going through a renewal of the Bereshis process. So there's a constant topping up of the mystery. As we discover, so God's topping up the mystery. It's a dynamic process. It's continually being refilled to the top. But in terms of looking at the structure of the Torah, up until the end of the sixth day, we're dealing with the creation of the mystery. And from the seventh day onwards, from that first Shabbos, when man comes into the picture, we're dealing with the discovery of the mystery. And that Medrash also is going to guide us to a great deal in the methodology that we're going to use to understand both the 6 days and the post-6 day period. Now, that's a very important starting point, and it's going to lead me into an extremely difficult concept, which I'm going to try and explain. Not I'm going to try, I'm going to explain to you. And I'm almost, I am 100% sure that you won't understand it. That you won't understand it because I know that even simpler things, very often you don't understand. No criticism against you. We're dealing with some very complex things. The question is not whether you understand or not. We're dealing with something that's really difficult in all the Shiurim, but particularly the section. Really difficult, really conceptually new, and virtually each Shiur has something of that in it. That it's virtually impossible to grasp it at the first time. That's clear. I have an advantage over you. I prepared the Shiur. I've been busy on it not only for weeks, I've been busy on it for years. So for me, I've got an advantage. Some of the ideas you're being exposed to the first time, it's not fair to expect you to understand after 1 hour what I've spent years and years developing. The question is, what do you do after you don't understand it? So some people go home, and that's the end. Some people are sure they do understand it. And occasionally you get a person who works on it, who discusses it, who looks at it, spends the whole week on it, comes back with a question later on, and they eventually do understand it. So I'm going to explain something to you in the knowledge that you won't understand it now, but in the hope that you'll work on it. And that as we move through, it's an idea that we'll be using in several of the Shiurim, and it'll become clearer as we go on through. This idea of the mystery and discovery dynamic, and the fact that the origin of it all, those 6 days, the origin of the whole world, is Hester Dover, is an element of mystery. Now, in all this, it's also important to appreciate that I'm not going to make any attempt to resolve science and the Torah, because I think that's an exercise in futility. Why should we try and bend the Torah to fit into science? Why don't they bend science to fit into the Torah? And who says they have to fit? And what's the terrible thing if they don't fit? There are lots and lots of things that science thought a couple of years ago, or 100 years ago, or 200 years ago, or 6 months ago, and they've changed their minds. They don't think the same as they thought 6 months ago. They don't think the same as they thought 2 years ago. It's constantly changing. Why do we have to keep running after them, twisting the Torah to try and make it fit in with their latest theories, and then they come along and dump the latest theories and come up with a new theory that's in any case closer to the Torah? It's not really important. They're two different disciplines. For example, there is no moral relevance to the question of whether the world is 5,756 years old or billions of years old. It actually makes no moral difference. It's irrelevant. So we're not going to deal with that question. It just has no relevance. If you're a scientist, it's relevant. There's a curiosity element. But it doesn't affect behavior. What does affect behavior is who created the world. Why did he create the world? What was his intention? That's what's important. How he created the world is not very important. Whether it was using evolutionary methods or non-evolutionary methods, I'll show you some of the Chazal, and you'll draw some of your own conclusions as to what is reconcilable and what isn't reconcilable. But it's not terribly important. What's important is that we understand the Torah properly. In the Torah, we're dealing with the why issues, not the how issues. In science, they're dealing with the how issues. And if there's a conflict that their explanation of how conflicts with our understanding of why, then I can tell you one thing, they're wrong and we're right. Because ours comes as a tradition that comes from Sinai. These are the reasons why. We don't know how God created it. We're given very scanty information. We don't know how God did it. The scientists will have to work it out. Provided that their explanation of how it happened doesn't conflict with our understanding of why it happened, then we're okay. So if the scientists will say it happened by coincidence, we'll say that's wrong. It's not true. It didn't happen by coincidence. It happened by divine intent. If the scientists say that there was a certain bang at a certain point and certain chemicals were released, that could be. How it exactly happened, we don't know. And they must work it out. That's their field. And that's their hakor dover. That's their analysis. But interesting, the Medrash says most of the analysis should be directed at the period after the sixth day. If you really want to understand life, start from the creation of man. Don't worry too much about what happened before then. It's not terribly important. How the world was created, where it started from. It's not very important. It's not going to change anybody's life. But to understand man's relationship to the world, that can change people's life. And that's where the Chakor Dover should be. That's where the analysis should be. And in fact, that Chazal tell us is part of the reason why the Torah starts with the letter Beis. And have a look at the Beis. The Torah suggests it should start with an Aleph. And then the Chazal said that the Aleph is the first letter. The Ten Commandments starts with an Aleph. The Torah also, it would have been made logical sense and aesthetic sense if the Torah would have started with an Aleph. But the form of the Beis is important. If you'll notice, the Beis has one opening. And that's on the left-hand side. It's like a bracket. And the indication is don't worry about what happened before, what's on top, what's below. Look ahead and analyze and watch ahead. Keep your eye on the future, because that's where everything is. You don't have to worry about what happened before creation. That's not the issue. It's from now on what happened. And that's really what we've got to focus on. In that first sentence, let's look at the first word and then we'll look at the first sentence. The first sentence word is Bereshis. Very interesting in that word is the trop under the word Bereshis. I don't know whether the children in schools are taught to use the trop, but they should be taught to use the trop. The trop is the little signs under the letter, sometimes on top of the letter, that tells the Baal Koireh how to sing. So it's the musical note. But what's important about the musical note, of course, is not just the music, but the way one reads it, the intonation. That, in fact, determines the phrasing. It determines the whole life of the sentence. The sentence has a life to it, and its life revolves around the music of the sentence. So it's important when we're interpreting the sentences to be looking not only at the word, but also to the accent and the intonation, the music that surrounds that word. And if you'll notice, the trop on the word Bereshis is counter to what it ought to be. Because the opening phrase is Bereshis Boro Elukim, in the beginning God created. But if you look at the trop, under the shin you'll see the trop, that little bracket there is called the tipcho, and it looks like a closing bracket. So using just simple hieroglyphic sense, you can work out that that's an indication to the reader to pause. It's like a comma. And it's more than a comma, it's almost like a semicolon. So the correct phrasing then is Bereshis, almost full stop. And that's a statement. Baro Elokim, Hashem created. It's not in the beginning God created. It clearly doesn't mean that. It must mean something else. What does it mean? What is the English translated as? In the beginning God created. Well, that's wrong. That we know is wrong. Now the question is, what does it mean? Well, we shouldn't say that's wrong altogether, because Unkelus translated as well. If you look at the Unkelus, what does it say? Bekadmin. You see that? The Unkelus is an Aramaic translation, the most authentic translation we have of the Torah, and one that we refer to very frequently. And he says Bekadmin, which means just that, in the beginning. So there is a view, the simple translation of Bereshis is in the beginning. One of the reasons we find that difficult is the trop, as I mentioned. The second thing, but Unkelus doesn't worry about the trop when he translates. He translates as accurately as he can from Hebrew to Aramaic. The second reason that it's difficult to understand is it would be the wrong word. It should say bitchilo. It should say, if it meant in the beginning, it should say in the beginning. And the Hebrew word for beginning is techilo. So it should say bitchilo, boro elokim, in the beginning God created. Bereshis doesn't mean that. Bereshis comes from the word rosh. And rosh means head. So what we've got to say is Bereshis, let's now translate it very, very literally, even more literally than Unkelus, even if it doesn't make sense. Let's first get the literal translation right and then decide whether it makes sense. Bereshis really then means in the head or with the head. Boro Elokim, Hashem created. Now do you realize what that starts meaning? God created the world with intellect. That's the meaning of Bereshis. Not in the beginning. With intellect, the Ribbono Shel created the world. God created the world with Rosh. He was using his head, and he gave the world a head. The essence of the world, that word, the opening phrase of the Torah, is intellect. Head. Thinking. That's what drives the world. Those of you who've got a Mikros Gedolus will notice on the left-hand side of your page, there are two other Targumim, there are two other translations. One is the Targum Yonason, and one is the Targum Yerushalmi. Targum Yonason uses a different Aramaic word to Unkelus, but it means the same, and that is min avlo baro, that Hashem created the world in the beginning. But the Talmud Yerushalmi translates it differently. How does the Yerushalmi translate it? Bechuchma baro Hashem. With wisdom God created. So there we see the authentic support for that view, that the word Bereshis means intellect, it doesn't mean in the beginning. Isn't it tragic in a way when one sits and one learns like this that there's a large crowd of very wonderful people over here, but isn't it tragic to think how many people there aren't
in the shiur tonight who will still go away thinking that Bereshis Bara Elokim means what they were taught when they were cheder children, in the beginning God created, and they will miss the essence of the entire Torah. The essence of the Torah is that the world was created with intellect, that that was the driving force of the world. Let's have a look at the implications of that. But to get to the implications, we need to go a little further. Before we go a little further, let me learn a medrash with you. The medrash says, HaTorah omeres ani hoyisi klei umonosu shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I was the tool that God used to create the world. Do you see again support for this principle? The Torah says, the Torah, which is the source of intellect, says, I was the tool that God used to create the world. If a king wants to build a palace, he doesn't just start building. He calls in an engineer and an architect. He calls in specialists. And the specialist, the engineer, doesn't just get bricks together and start building. He has tables and he has logarithms and he has calculations. There's a whole chokhmah that goes together with it. It was interesting, I was doing some work with South African Airways the other day, and I was speaking to a man. I said, what's your job here? So he opens his briefcase and he pulls out two thick books. And he says, I produce this. I said, that's in it. Is that all you do? He says, that's all I do. I said, what is this? He says, have a look. I look inside it, can't understand a word of it. He says, what this is when a pilot's on a particular runway anywhere in the world, he's told what the weather is, he's told what the wind is, he's told how long the runway is. He uses my book to figure out how heavy his plane can be if he wants to get into the air before he gets to the end of the runway. So it's quite an important book if you happen to be a passenger on the plane. One realizes the chokhmah. Here's a fellow who has a whole department producing books which we don't even see. We don't even know they exist. And without it, the whole thing doesn't work. So the Midrash, things don't just happen. There's a chokhmah to everything. There's a science to everything. There's a discipline to everything. There are systems to everything. And you need to know those formula before you start. You need to understand the formula. So the king wants a palace. That's fine. He gets the engineers. But even the engineers consult the formulas. God himself needs the formulas to create the world. Where does he get the formulas? Mabit Batur over Soilum. This is the book that's the equivalent of the book that the engineer was showing me. Here are all the formulas. You want to know how to make the world work? It's all in here. So now what do we see? This is a second rather important discovery that stems out of the first. The Torah wasn't designed to preserve the world. The Torah wasn't designed to look after society, to create to regularize society. And to regulate society, that's what it wasn't created for. The Torah existed long before the world, as the Midrash says further on. The Torah are the absolute formulas. The Torah are exactly like that book. The Torah are the formulas. The book is where the life is where it all happens. God created a world to give life to the formulas, but the formulas existed before. So, there's not a law, thou shalt not murder, because they're human beings who like to murder each other. There are human beings who like to murder each other so as to give life to the law that thou shalt not murder. The law thou shalt not murder was there before. And then God created people with angers and with jealousies and with weapons so that the principle of thou shalt not murder could become real, it could be lived. But thou shalt not murder existed before there were any people to murder or to be murderers. And so with every law of the Torah, they exist independently as a model. And the world was created as the laboratory, as the place where you could take the model and see it working in real life, and then deal with it, with the difficulties of implementing it, of the excitements of implementing it, of the challenges of implementing it, of the implications of implementing it. That's what the world is all about. You're implementing something which existed before the world was created. The world was designed to fulfill, to satisfy the formulas. And so it is. You take it, it's exactly the same in science and engineering. If you look at an aeroplane, to keep the same image, it's not that the wind is created to support aeroplanes, and that gravity is created so that the aeroplane comes down afterwards. It's not that at all. The aeroplane is designed taking into account all the forces of nature which are there already. So the world is designed taking into account all the forces of morality which were there before. And that's the Torah. And that again sets the Torah apart from any other system of psychology, of morality, of philosophy, of anything else, in the understanding that it's a model that existed on its own before the creation. And that begins to give us a bit more of an understanding of what Bereshis Boro Elokim means. God created the world with that intellect. The intellect existed first. And God created the world out of that intellect. And that's the difficult concept that I'm going to still try and develop this evening, and we'll have to continue with next week, is the understanding of what that means to create something out of intellect. Let's go further in the verse. So, with intellect, God created the world. Es ha-shomayim ve'es ha-aretz, heaven and earth. By that, the understanding would be heaven, that means the spiritual world, and oretz, the material world. So God created two worlds, the material world and the physical world. Let's read on, because you'll see the difficulties only when we read on. V'ha'oretz ha'isa tohu v'avohu. And the earth was, the material world, was tohu v'avohu, was upside down, topsy-turvy, all sorts of empty, desolate, all sorts of words that one could use to translate tohu v'avohu. V'choshech al p'nei tohoim, and there was darkness on the face of the deep, of the depths. V'ruach elokim, and a wind from God, merachefes al p'nei hamoim, was blowing, was hovering over the face of the water. When was the water created? We haven't been told water was created. We've been told the spiritual world was created and material world was created. Where's water all of a sudden? Therefore says, and then it goes, let's do the next sentence. Vayomer Elokim, and Hashem said, Yehi or, let there be light. Vayehi or, and there was light. Although the sun is only created on the third day. Sorry? On the fourth day. Thanks, Moshe. Based on that, Rashi says the order can't be right. The Torah can't be giving us the correct order. First heaven and earth and so on. Can't be giving us right because we see the inconsistency in the verse. In which case, how do we read it? So it doesn't mean, and that's one of another reason why Bereshis can't mean in the beginning. Because if it meant in the beginning, then it would mean in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Then what happened with water? It should have said in the beginning God created the water and the heavens and the earth. Another indication that Bereshis doesn't mean in the beginning. So what does it mean? How we now have to read it is the following. Bereshis Boro Elokim, with intellect God created, Es HaShomayim Ve'es HaOretz, heaven and earth, meaning everything that there is in the spiritual world and everything in the physical world. So the entire universe is created. So you'll want to know what are the rest of the 6 days got to do. We'll see. But if we read it the way I'm suggesting, then Bereshit doesn't mean in the beginning. It means the first statement is God created heaven and earth with intellect. That's the statement. V'ha'oretz, and the material world, which he created with his intellect, was desolate. The material world consisted of all sorts of things. But the very first thing God did, and it's in the third verse that we start beginning to get to the hows a little bit, to how God actually did it or what the process was, where it says, Vayomer Elokim, that's the first statement, the first expression of will, the first translation of an idea into reality. Vayomer Elokim, Yehi Or, let there be light. If we read Bereshis as meaning in the beginning, then the way you would need to read it, as Rashi says is one of the possibilities, is, in the beginning of God's creation of heaven and earth, He said, let there be light. In other words, again, the first thing that happened was, let there be light. Saying that in the very beginning. What was the very beginning? Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, let there be light. Now, I need to read to you a small section of Ramban. V'yata, says the Ramban. And now, Shema Perush HaMikro Al Pshutoi Nochoin Uvor. Ramban, in his typically modest way, says, after having demolished all the other ways of understanding these verses, says, and now, listen to the straightforward explanation of these verses in their correctness and clarity. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Baro Kol HaNivroim Me'afiso Muchletis. God created all of the creation from absolute nothingness. Now that's a very difficult concept. How do you create something from nothing? And we're going to deal with that. That's an important principle. Ve'ein etzleinu beloshon hakodesh behitzos hayesh mi'ayin ela loshon bara. The only word that means that in Hebrew, creating something out of nothing, is the word bara, create. We have all sorts of other words for form, for manufacture, for evolve, but the word bara, whenever it's used, means to create something out of nothing. Ve'ein kol ha'nase tachas ha'shemesh ulamala hove min ha'ayin hatchala rishona aval hitzi min ha'efes ha'gomer ha'muchlot. Everything comes out of that absolute nothingness, and everything evolved from the one thing that was created out of the nothingness. What was created out of the nothingness? Yesoid dak me'oid ein bo mamash. A very, very fine element that actually can't be touched. So again, if you want to say in terms of physics that it's the hydrogen atom, you can say it's the hydrogen atom. It doesn't matter what exactly it is. But he says only one thing was created to start with, from nothing. That was, let's say, the hydrogen atom, because in terms of the Ramban's wording and our scientific knowledge today, that's all it could be. The simplest, smallest, finest of all atoms, of all elements, the hydrogen atom was created. It is almost nothing. Look at a hydrogen atom, it's nothing, it's virtually nothing, and from that everything else, all the other elements develop. Aval hu koyach mamtzi, the essence of this element is its power to create, it's a power to evolve into other forms. Muchon lekabel atzuro velotzeis min hakoyach el hapoel. It's able to take different forms and to move from potential to actual. And after that, lo boro dova, nothing else was created, says the Ramban after that. Aval yotzar v'oso mimenu, everything else evolved, was formed from that original creation. So the only thing that was created was one substance. That substance is extremely fine. It has the capacity to change into other more complex substances, and it's a koyach, it's an energy. It's virtually not matter. Ki mimenu himtzi hakol, from this God made everything. Now he goes on to say something which in a sense will challenge. V'da, and no, ki ha'shamayim v'chol asher bo m'chomer echod, the heavens and everything in it is made out of one kind of basic element. V'ha'oretz v'chol asher bo m'chomer echod, and the material world and everything in it is made from another basic element. V'ha'kodesh baruch hu boro elu shneihem me'ayin, and these two elements were created by God, the spiritual component and the physical component, ushneim levodim nivroim, and that was the only thing that was created, by kol nasi mehem. And that's called tohu vavohu, says the Ramban. That's what tohu vavohu means, this very, very fine material that was created. What I want to look at with you for the remaining few minutes is, what did God create? It's alright, the Ramban said it's created from ayin, from nothing. What does that mean? How do you create that atom from nothing? If we look at the meaning of the verses again, and we say, what's the very first act of creation? What did God create? Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or. God said, let there be light. And as we said, the sun and the other sources of light and physical energy were created on the fourth day, and therefore, what was this Or that Hashem created on the first day? Now, I've always preferred, instead of translating Or as simply as light, to translate it as energy. In which case, what we would say is, Hashem said as the starting point was, let there be energy. And the Medrash goes into an interesting discussion, and there are two views on it, as to whether God created energy and from that evolved matter, or whether God created matter and from that evolved energy. But both views take it for granted that matter and energy, there is a formula that matter and energy can be transformed one into the other. It took Einstein a little bit longer to discover that, but the Chazal took that absolutely for granted several thousand years ago already. That matter could be formed from energy, and energy could be formed from matter, that they were the same basic unit, and one could start with either of them and go either way. And the question was, did God start off with the land, and later on he said, let that evolve into energy? Did he start off with matter and say, let the matter produce energy? Or did he start with energy? Was the first thing you hear, start with energy, and that evolved into matter? And the prevailing view is the second one. That's the view that we're going to follow, that that Hashem started off, his first statement was Yehi O, let there be energy. And using Einstein's formula, we know that it's not too difficult for God to develop all the matter he wants to from the energy once he's got it. And that energy obviously is closely related to hydrogen. So the jump from energy to hydrogen is a little easier. So the Ramban says, matter was created from nothing. He says, from nothing material. Matter was created from energy, from something non-material. It is possible to create material from non-material. That's a scientific fact which today we know. Of course, had I given the shiur to you 100 years ago, you would have laughed. That's why I say we don't have to make the Torah fit into science. Science eventually fits itself into the Torah. Give it enough time and it comes around to it. But this is what we've been teaching for hundreds of years, for thousands of years. Where does the energy come from? That's the important thing. Where's the energy from? Says Rashi, let's look back at your Rashi. Those of you who want to look inside. In the second Rashi, in the first sentence, still in the Rashi on Bereshis Boro, the second Rashi, few lines from the beginning. Ulhoiroi said that Abrio Gamkin Yevshar, the purpose of these verses can't be to be describing the order of creation. Kemoshikosov Razal, Bishvil Hatoiro Shenikres Reshis Darku. Again, that word Reshis is sometimes, the Torah is sometimes referred to as Reshis, which now makes good sense. As I said to you, Reshis comes from the word Rosh. The Yerushalmi translates Reshis as Chokhmah, so as intellect. The Torah is sometimes referred to as Reshis. Because, why is that so? I spoke last Rosh Hashanah a year ago about the meaning of Rosh. What does a Rosh mean? Rosh means a beginning in a sense. I talked about Rosh Hashanah. What does a Rosh Hashanah mean? Why don't we call it Tchilas Hashanah, the beginning of the year? Why do we call it Rosh Hashanah? And I talked about the relationship of the head to the rest of the body, the head to the rest of the personality, head to the rest of the being of the human being. And we said the head is not just where the body starts. The head is the driving force of the body. The head determines your moods. The head energizes you, in fact. That's what people have now come to understand. It's taken a long time. But that your main energy doesn't come from the food that you eat. The food that you eat gives your body the capacity to function. But what really energizes you, what really makes the difference between a person who can achieve enormous energy, expend enormous energy in the achievement of great excellence in any field, even in the physical field, even in sport, is the way he's psyched up. It's a question of his motivation. It's a question of his mental focus. It's not a question of whether he had jungle oats for breakfast or not. That's not the issue. That's not what differentiates the great performer from the mediocre performer, what he eats. All the years, people thought it's just physical exercise and food. And now they're understanding it's not that at all. Of course you need to be in physical top shape. But then, when you're competing with other people who are also in physical top form, the differentiation is going to be in the mental sense. Is how focused you are, how you're able to think. That's what's going to determine the difference. So the head is much more than the starting point of the body. The head is the driving force of the body. And I spoke about that's what Rosh Hashanah means, that Rosh Hashanah has the capacity to drive the year, not just to be the starting point of the year. Using that understanding, when we say Bereshis, linking in its meaning of beginning with its meaning of intellect and head, what we're really saying is that the starting point of anything is the intellect behind it, and that drives it. Whether it's a human being trying to perform, whether it's a system, whether it's a business organization, whether it's a country, whether it's a nation, whatever it is, it's the intellectual idea that underlies it that actually drives it. That's where one really has to focus one's attention if one wants to get to the bottom of it. And the difficult idea that I'm going to start off with now, and we'll develop further next time, is the energy was created from the Torah. The Torah is not one. We have to make a major paradigm shift in our thinking here, and that's why I said it's difficult, and I don't expect you to do it in an hour. And that is that intellect is not static, and it's not dry, and it's not thin, and it's not in a book. That intellect is a source of energy. That's what we have to get. Now, emotionally, that's not a difficult thing to understand. When you've understood something very nicely, if you've had some very stimulating learning, or you've heard a wonderful lecture, or you've read a wonderful book, you are energized afterwards. It doesn't mean not necessarily that the book was talking about the thing that you want to be energized in necessarily. So you might have just read a very good book on some philosophic concept, or you might have looked at a very beautiful painting in an art gallery, and then you want to run a marathon, and you'll say, what has the one got to do with the other? But it's energized you. The fact is, you're able to move with greater energy. When you've grasped something, when you've understood something, when you've penetrated something intellectually, there is a capacity to draw on an energy that is enormous. And when that understanding is emes as well, when it's true, when you're tapping into the truth, it's even more so. And when you're tapping into the Torah, what are you linking into? The Torah really are the electronic cables, or now they can be it can be non-cable now, it can be cellular. It's the radio connection between ourselves and God. That's the only way we have of tapping into God's energy. We need to think of God, as far as we can, as some incredibly enormous source of energy. Just think of all the energy in the world, all the stars in the world, all the energy in the world, all the potential energy in the world, all the atom bombs that the world could produce if you were to take every atom of plutonium available in the world and split it. And think of all the energy in the entire world. And realize that's just a little spark that comes off from the source of energy, which is the Ribbono Shel Olam. One needs to see the Ribbono Shel Olam as an incredible source of energy. And the Torah is the channel of communication, of being able to draw on that energy. And that energy is intellect. This new idea that I'm trying to bring us into understanding is the relationship between intellect and energy. That there is an energy in intellect that is able to be translated, just as Einstein discovered that you can take material energy and translate it into matter. That's a much bigger chiddush, that's a much bigger paradigm shift than the one I'm asking you to make. I'm asking you to say that you can translate intellect into energy, and then energy into matter. If you can make that linkage, don't worry about the energy into matter, because Einstein's already worked that out for you. All you still have to work out is the understanding that intellect can be translated into energy. And I've given you emotional examples of where it's done. It happens in our own lives all the time. So intuitively you know that it's right. You just need to grasp it intellectually. That you can convert intellect into energy. Then you can convert energy into matter. That we know. Which means, therefore, that you can convert intellect into matter. That's what's important to understand. And having understood that, one understands what we mean when we say, Bereshis Boro Elokim Es HaShamayim Ves Haaretz. Where does it all come from? Intellect was converted into energy, and energy was converted into matter. But if you want to know what the world is, whether you're looking at the most physical analysis of a physical atom, or you're looking at the analysis of a concept, what the world is Bereshis. And that's what drives the world. That's what drives every atom in the world. That's what drives every person in the world. That's what drives every relationship in the world, is the energy with which the world was created. And our access to the understanding of that energy and to the manipulation of that energy, to the mastery of that energy, is through the Torah. That's what the Torah is. That's what we're studying. That's what we're trying to understand. Now realize what power the Torah can give. What understanding one can grasp if one's able to learn the Torah accurately and correctly. What mastery that can give of the world, of what's happening in the world, of how to repair things that are happening in the world. We don't always find it easy to implement our understandings. But let's worry about that separately. Let's first stand in awe of the limitlessness, of the depth and clarity of our potential understanding of the world, once we've got this principle clear. And we now use this as we progress through the Torah to try and get behind, to get under the world and understand the Chochmah principles, the principles of Reishis, those intellectual principles that God used to form the world in which we live. In order to facilitate that process, obviously the one process is the Motzei Shabbos Shir, which we'll be going through and we'll be doing just this. But of course, to be able to achieve some kind of skill in this process, it's necessary to be exposed to a sophisticated methodology of Gemara learning. Unfortunately, a lot of the Gemara learning that goes on in the world today is turning pages, it's translating. That's not understanding the world using these principles that we've described today. And for the purpose of linking this into the Gemara, I'm starting a specific Gemara shir from next Sunday morning after the davening. So it'll be a Gemara shir. I don't mind if ladies come and sit. They need to sit separately, obviously, but I don't mind if a lady wants to come and listen. It's not the kind of material that women usually enjoy, but some do. So I have no objection if ladies want to sit and listen to it. It's a Gemara Shir that will be designed for how shall I put it, for technical beginners, but on a sophisticated intellectual level. So I will assume very little or no technical knowledge. It's open to those who have the technical knowledge as well, because it will be a different way of approaching Gemara. But specifically, it's to enable those people who do not have a technical background to be able to see how we develop the skills and the methodology of extracting these principles from Torah. So you're not going to see it happening exactly on the first Sunday. It's a skills share. It's a process of analyzing the Torah in a way that yields the kind of understanding that I've been describing to you this evening. So that, together with the continuing Saturday night series, should give you the capacity to take the study further. About 8:30, Sunday morning.